For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An estimated 40,000 children in New Mexico were raised by grandparents or a relative in 2024, according to that state's Aging and Long-Term Services Department. A bill in the New Mexico legislature would create a pilot program to assist these kinship caregivers. Jeanette DeDios has more.
The three-year pilot program would assist kinship caregivers in Rio Arriba, Santa Fe, Taos, McKinley, and Doña Ana counties, targeting 50 participants in each area. One quarter of grandparents raising grandchildren in New Mexico live in poverty. Kinship care is growing here despite declining in the rest of the country. And one of the reasons is parents struggling with substance use disorders. According to the Fiscal Impact Report, the bill originally had a $4.5 million appropriation, but an amended version changed that to $4 million. The program would be administered through the Aging and Long-Term Services Department and would provide resources like public assistance, economic support, and legal services. Democratic Representative Michelle Paulina Beta is a co-sponsor, and she and her husband are kinship caregivers themselves. Abeda is a lawyer, and even she finds the system difficult to navigate.
Sometimes the system is not designed to be one of support, right? And so with this bill, what we're looking at doing is empowering the way that we help families.
Abeda says this bill is to support families who want to obtain legal custody or official guardianship.
Because so many times those legal fees are what make families concerned about not proceeding through the court system.
The legislative session ends on March 22nd. I'm Jeanette Didier.
And on this day in 1806, the Lewis and Clark expedition were near what would become known as the Oregon coast. They lost a canoe and sent an interpreter to buy two from the Clatsops. They also described fish later identified as the sockeye salmon and steelhead trout, which was new to science at that time. And they also mentioned the Indians eating starry flounder. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 13th, 2025.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158.
Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, and Suzanne Potter.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Canada retaliates in trade war with the United States. U.S. aid to nuclear inspectors is cut off as tensions rise with Iran. And while Trump pressures Ukraine, Europe responds. First, Canada retaliates. The tariff war is only getting started. Before leaving office, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spoke to the American people. He blamed the trade war on Trump, saying it was difficult to determine Trump's true intentions in imposing tariffs. Perhaps he wants to sink the Canadian economy so he can annex Canada, Trudeau said. That's never going to happen. We will never be the 51st state. Addressing Donald, Trudeau also said, "You're a very smart guy, but this is a very dumb thing to do." Dumb, it so happens, is also what the Wall Street Journal said. And dumb it is. On Tuesday, Trump added to his initial 25% tariff on Canadian goods with a 50% tariff on Canadian steel and aluminum. And he has by no means discarded his notion of acquiring Canada, saying on social media, quote, "The artificial line of separation drawn many years ago will finally disappear." This was in response to Ontario Premier Doug Ford's announcement of a 25% surcharge on energy exports to the U.S., which would mainly affect Minnesota, Michigan, and New York. Before the day was over, however, the surcharge was suspended after U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick agreed to talks with Ford. Trump then suspended the 50% tariff. Canada's new Prime Minister and Liberal Party leader, Mark Carney, vows that, quote, "My government will keep our tariffs on until the Americans show us respect and make credible, reliable commitments to free and fair trade." Carney, a banker, has plenty of experience with financial crises, but has never been elected to office. About 150,000 party members cast nearly 86% of their vote for him over former Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland. "Canada never, ever will be part of America in any way, shape, or form," Carney declared. "So Americans should make no mistake. In trade, as in hockey, Canada will win." Carney is expected to call for elections very soon. He will face Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservative Party. Carney holds the lead in polls. But no matter who wins, expect Canada's retaliatory policy to stand. Poilievre said Trump's tariffs, quote, "cannot in any way be justified and are yet another betrayal by the president of the long friendship between Canada and the United States." Poilievre urged the Canadian government to retaliate by imposing identical tariffs. The U.S. imports more than three times the amount of steel from Canada that it exports there. While Trump pressures Ukraine, Europe responds. Ratcheting up the pressure on Ukraine to support his so-called peace plan, Trump paused all U.S. aid to Ukraine. He said that Ukraine's agreement to a minerals deal will, quote, "not be enough" to satisfy him. Then, just 2 days ago, he reversed the pause on military aid to Ukraine, including intelligence sharing, saying Ukraine had agreed to a 30-day ceasefire with Russia. Russia has yet to agree. Trump clearly is determined to force President Zelensky into a peace agreement that will cost Ukraine dearly, cost Russia nothing, and bring no peace. Europeans are rallying to Ukraine and once again looking to the roughly $300 billion in frozen Russian assets to help. Donald Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, posted on X last month, quote, "Let's finance our aid for Ukraine from the Russian frozen assets. Enough talking. It's time to act." The money is owned by Russia's central bank, but was frozen by the U.S., the European Union, Britain, and others after Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. The aim was to punish President Putin for his unprovoked attack and to cut off funds he could use to wage war and compensate Ukraine for its losses. The U.S. holds about $25 billion of that money, which probably means Ukraine will not get access to it while Trump is president. But the remaining $275 billion is there, provided certain legal obstacles can be overcome, the main one being that the money is, after all, Russia's, and seizing it might violate international law. The latest estimate, by the way, to repair war damage is $524 billion, according to an update released last week by the World Bank. U.S. aid to nuclear inspectors is cut off as tensions rise with Iran. Trump's executive order freezing all aid programs hurt a number of vital programs besides the much-discussed USAID humanitarian assistance. The cutoff also suspended aid from Energy Department laboratories that support the International Atomic Energy Agency Inspector Corps. Two programs have been frozen, one in Vienna and the other in the United States. These programs, among other things, recruit atomic inspectors, train them, and supply them with equipment. The U.S. action may directly affect inspection of Iran's nuclear program, especially since traces of highly enriched uranium have recently been found at four nuclear sites. More than that, the two programs are linked, an international effort to preserve nuclear nonproliferation. Some observers worry that this initial freeze might go farther and be applied to international efforts to curb other weapons of mass destruction. This news comes as Trump reveals that he sent a letter to Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, offering a choice between a nuclear deal and an attack. On Fox Business, Trump said, quote, "There are two ways Iran can be handled, militarily or you make a deal. I would prefer to make a deal because I'm not looking to hurt Iran. They're great people." But Trump said time was a-wasting. We're down to final strokes with Iran, he told reporters. We can't let them have a nuclear weapon. The Iranians have to consider three things when deciding how to respond to Trump. One, that Trump has before him a presidential memorandum that advocates regime change. Two, that Israel's far-right faction would like nothing more than a green light to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. And three, that Iran's air defenses have been badly weakened by Israel's attacks last October. In Iran's politics, moreover, Khamenei and President Masoud Pezeshkian have sparred over how to respond, if at all, to Trump, with the president seeming to believe that a nuclear deal that would end sanctions on Iran might be worth pursuing. But the more Trump threatens, the less likely he is to get what he wants. We've been down this road before. In his first term, Trump accepted advice to promote regime change by withdrawing from the Obama-era nuclear deal, which was working, and imposing heavy sanctions in the belief Iran would be brought to its knees. That didn't work then, and Khamenei's position now that the Americans can't be trusted to honor agreements surely stems in large part from that prior experience with Trump. As he hears what Trump's officials are threatening, the Ayatollah has further reason for resisting. In a speech at the Economic Club of New York on Friday, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent described an economic pressure campaign on Iran that he said would target, quote, all stages of Iran's oil supply chain. He threatened to close off Iran's access to the international financial system and shut down Iran's oil sector and drone manufacturing capabilities. Making Iran broke again, he said, will mark the beginning of our updated sanctions policy. If economic security is national security, the regime in Tehran will have neither. As is so often the case, U.S. officials just don't get that nationalism is a popular force in other countries and often takes precedence over cost-benefit calculations. President Pezeshkian is reported by Iran's state media to have said the other day, quote, "It is unacceptable for us that they, the United States, gives orders and makes threats. I won't even negotiate with you. Do whatever the hell you want." In other news, Trump threatens sanctions on Russia, but don't believe it. Has Donald Trump reassessed his pro-Russia stance? He said on March 7 that he was strongly considering imposing sanctions and tariffs on Russia, apparently to nudge Putin to accept a ceasefire and permanent settlement of the war. To be sure, Trump is determined to play the peacemaker. I wouldn't be surprised if he has a Nobel Peace Prize in mind, and is discouraged by the lack of progress in Russia-Ukraine talks. Trump is in a hurry, but Putin smells total victory and is making demands that may obstruct a settlement, such as a commitment to block Ukrainian membership in NATO forever, no NATO troops in Ukraine, and assurances that Russia retains its occupied territory in Ukraine. Trump is making his usual claims without evidence that there is a lot of progress in talks with Russia and that the Russians want to make a deal because in a different way from Ukraine that only I know, he said. They have no choice. Only he knows, and he ain't telling. Actually, Russia has many choices, whereas Ukraine has none. So let's see if Trump can get a verifiable 30-day ceasefire out of Putin. As for the sanctions, John Bolton, Trump's former advisor, made 2 points on CNN about the limited value of sanctions on Russia. First, that there's very little business to sanction on tariffs or banking. And second, that Russia has been very successful at evading sanctions during the 3 years of war. So sanctions on Russia? Meaningless and not credible. At least one Republican has broken with Trump on sanctions on Russia. Senator Lindsey Graham, of all people, warned on Sunday, quote, "As long as the fighting is going on, if we pull the plug on Ukraine, it would be worse than Afghanistan." He said this during an interview on Fox News Sunday. "Until we have a ceasefire, I would give Ukraine what they need in terms of intelligence and weapons to defend themselves. In terms of Russia, I'll be introducing sanctions on their banking sector and their energy sector next week, urging them to get to the table. If they don't engage in ceasefire and peace talks with the administration, we should sanction the hell out of them." Next, Israel plans to starve and empty Gaza. Ongoing peace talks notwithstanding, Israel seems bent on denying Palestinians in Gaza the means of survival, apparently forcing them to emigrate. Israel now controls all aid entering Gaza, operating a single entry point. Israel has cut off all electricity to Gaza in addition to all humanitarian assistance except water. This news comes amidst uncertainty about the availability of USAID funds now that Secretary of State Marco Rubio's order to cut aid was overturned by a court order. Lancet reports that the death toll in Gaza is 40% higher than reported before, 64,260 as of the end of June, with 59% being women, children, and people over 65. Having made life in Gaza almost impossible, Israel's far right, led by Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, has unveiled a new emigration authority that will be in charge of deporting all Gazans. The new agency will be co-led by the Defense Ministry and the Office of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It would receive enough funding to carry out what he envisions as a massive logistical operation to find destination countries that will accept and employ Palestinians from Gaza. Smotrich said it was President Trump who inspired this plan when Trump urged Israel to clean out Gaza so that he and Jared Kushner could develop it. Trump takes aim at the CHIPS and Science Act. In yet another example of this administration's bizarre thinking, it is starting to dismantle the act, which was designed to do precisely what Trump says is the aim of his tariff policy, support investment in chip making at home. The CHIPS and Science Act was a bipartisan effort under Joe Biden. It subsidizes semiconductor manufacturing as a means of keeping that crucial industry at home and luring semiconductor makers like Taiwan's TSMC to invest in the United States. All the big U.S. chip makers have pledged major investments in new facilities. How Trump will get around the signed contracts, valued at $36 billion, is a big question. But in the meantime, CHIPS staff are being reduced. Todd Young, Republican of Indiana and author of the act, was beside himself to rationalize Trump's move, noting that the money has nearly all been spent. So why is Trump doing this? Reports say it's out of Trump's personal animus toward Biden. Finally, here are two updates. China has been defiant in the face of Trump's tariffs. Beijing announced that in response to the 20% tariff hike by the U.S., it would be imposing 15% tariffs on imports of chicken, wheat, corn, and cotton from the U.S., as well as a 10% tariff on imports of U.S. sorghum, soybeans, pork, beef, aquatic products, fruits, vegetables, and dairy products. And in the Philippines, the former president has been arrested. The International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Rodrigo Duterte, the former president from 2016 to 2022, whose war on drugs claimed an estimated 30,000 lives. The charge is crimes against humanity. He will stand trial in The Hague, Netherlands, though he is also running for a Senate seat back in the Philippines. His daughter Sarah is the vice president of the Philippines and has expressed outrage at the arrest. The families of Duterte and President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. have a long-running feud. And finally, this bit of humor. Donald Trump says he will buy a brand new Tesla to support poor Elon Musk in his hour of need. Trump adds that it should be illegal to boycott Tesla. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Noreen Shaw, the Deputy Director of Government Affairs Equality Division at the ACLU. She's here to talk with me about the No Bailout for Sanctuary Cities Act, which Congress is expected to consider soon. Welcome to the show, Noreen.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. So President Trump's immigration orders have caused a lot of alarm and fear for our local communities. And there's been some solace for folks out here because Oregon is a sanctuary state and Portland is a sanctuary city. But that could mean becoming the target of this new piece of legislation. What can you tell me about this act?
Yeah, this is a really dangerous bill that we actually call the Defund Our Communities Act, because it would do just that. If enacted, it would cut federal funds to hundreds of communities across the country freezing funds that are critical for our communities. We're talking about losing the funding that social workers, police officers, teachers, bus drivers, all of them, that they rely on to be able to serve our communities. And we're really concerned that communities are going to be hurt in ways, and we're talking about losing the local bus line, losing Meals on Wheels, just ways that have nothing to do with immigration whatsoever, that we think voters are really concerned about, and Congress shouldn't be handing this kind of power to the Trump administration at this time.
Like you mentioned, there is a wide array of programs that might be implicated. Is the act specific about what those might be, or more broad?
It's broad. It names federal funding for food, shelter, health care services, legal services, and transportation, but it leaves the door open to, quote, any funding being cut, and it would apply to any jurisdiction that is labeled a sanctuary jurisdiction. So for Oregon communities, it means the entire state, the state's funding that it gets from the federal government, but it also could mean local municipality funding, either because the local municipality gets matching grants from the state, or because maybe the local fire department or law enforcement agency gets grants from the federal government directly, and they would lose that funding if they are not willing to hold people for ICE in their jails.
Looking at this from like a national perspective, how many jurisdictions would be impacted by this act that have a sanctuary status?
Yeah, we don't know how the Trump administration will use this bill, but we're really concerned that they will use it to really the greatest extent that their imagination allows them to. So hundreds and hundreds of communities around the country, including a lot of communities that wouldn't even think of themselves as sanctuary states or sanctuary cities. And that's because of the way that the bill is written. It's really written in a broad way and says that if you as a jurisdiction are not holding people for ICE, no matter what the reason is, you will be considered a sanctuary jurisdiction. I've talked to law enforcement officials in different parts of the country. They've told me, I can't hold people for ICE because I don't have the staff to actually hold all these people in my local jail. Or I'm worried I'll get sued if I hold people for ICE beyond the release date that they'd otherwise be released under. So it's really putting local law enforcement agencies into a terrible bind. It's harming the ability of a lot of different kinds of public servants to do their job, because it's saying we'll punish you by taking away your funding for making a decision about how to use local resources. And we think that's actually something that should be offensive to people, no matter what their political stripe, no matter how they feel about immigrants and mass deportations. It's just, these are local decision-making issues, and it's not right for the federal government, for the Trump administration, to be coming in and trying to dictate terms.
Well, the No Bailout for Sanctuary Cities Act also brings in the Supreme Court case NFIB versus Sebelius, where the court ruled that Congress cannot attach coercive restrictions to funding programs. How might that precedent come into play here?
Well, you know, what we know from the Trump administration so far is that they've been threatening state and local officials, and it's really a campaign of intimidation. And we should see it as part of the threats to our democratic system as a whole, our system of checks and balances and powers between the federal government and the state government being divided and really independent in many ways. And what's happening here is the Trump administration wants to have an iron grip on all dissent in this country, all elected officials. For them, they need to toe the line. And if elected officials don't toe the line, by this administration, they're being threatened with criminal prosecution, and they're being threatened with defunding. And so we're at a really dangerous moment for our republic, where we need to make sure that Congress actually stands up for all of our rights, our civil rights, but also stands up for our democratic system of government that divides power, that has checks and balances, that say state and local governments can make decisions about how they use their resources, and if they decide not to use their resources for the federal government's agenda, that's okay, because we have that divided government. We have the ability of state and local governments to choose their own way. That's what was really at stake in the Supreme Court case that you mentioned, and what we're really concerned about as we look to these continued attacks on states.
How does this attempt to target sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, compare to actions taken in the first Trump administration?
Yeah, we saw some of these same attacks during the first Trump administration. And I like to tell people that everything that we are experiencing now, we saw something like it in the first Trump administration, but this is those attacks on steroids. And it seems to me that the Trump administration has been emboldened to really exert all the power that it believes that it has in this political moment. So while the Trump administration put forward claims in court during that first go-around that were rejected by those courts, that, you know, the idea that they could force state and local governments to do their bidding, to carry out deportations, courts said no, state governments have the right to control their own resources. Despite that, we see them coming back with this argument, the same argument that was rejected by courts, with even fuller force, with even more aggressively. We wrote the Department of Justice a couple weeks ago saying these claims that you're making about the law are legally baseless, but we continue to see them making those same claims. And unfortunately, the chilling effect is huge. You know, state and local officials are trying to make decisions about how they use their time and their money, and they're going to be concerned about the potential loss of federal funding that they really desperately need. It puts them into a real tough bind.
That kind of goes into this next question I had. Oregon has the oldest sanctuary state law in the nation, and it was strengthened again in 2021 through the Sanctuary Promise Act. Could a different type of federal legislation, a different strategy perhaps, override those protections?
I think we should feel pretty good about the Oregon laws being respected by people in the state of Oregon, by state and local law enforcement agencies that continue to be beholden to those laws, but only up to the point where we start to see violations. I know that's actually been a major concern in the state of Oregon, that, you know, some local law enforcement might decide that they're just going to kind of take the law into their own hands and take part in mass deportations. And that's a huge problem. So the law, the state law is valid, but that doesn't mean that we're always going to see compliance by local law enforcement. It's something that state authorities have to guard against. We need to continue to see enforcement of the Oregon Promise Act. And when it comes to the federal government's threats, you know, if the federal government took the state to court over its lack of participation in mass deportations, we'd see a lot of those same arguments that we've been making. And I think we'd see them run the course really successfully, that under the 10th Amendment of our Constitution, the state government does not have to provide its resources. It can't be commandeered by the federal government for a federal program, which is what immigration enforcement is.
As immigration and sanctuary cities have become, again, a target for the Trump administration, do you see that there's a need for myth busting about, you know, what is possible and what's within their power?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the greatest myths about sanctuary cities is this idea that criminals are walking free in them, and that's completely false. Even in a so-called sanctuary state or sanctuary city, state and local law enforcement agencies can use ordinary criminal laws. They can they can investigate and arrest people who are non-citizens in the same way they do citizens. And once a person is arrested and brought into a local jail and fingerprinted, that information goes to the federal government, and it goes to the Department of Homeland Security, which can make a decision about whether to try to pick that person up from local custody and try to deport them. So it's really a matter of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, having made the decision to prioritize picking somebody up from local law enforcement. That happens in sanctuary states, that happens in non-sanctuary states, because it's a matter of a federal program called Secure Communities. What we do see is that ICE has got to make decisions about who it sees as a priority. I mean, they are not going to be able to pick up every single person around the country who's brought in for some kind of traffic violation. And that's where the rub comes in, because we can't ask local law enforcement agencies to pick up the slack when the federal government isn't bringing somebody in for federal charges. It can't be the case that the federal government can kind of transfer this responsibility for immigration enforcement to the localities without actually giving the localities any funding or any support to do that work. I think that's part of the real problem here, is that if you're a local, let's say you're a local prosecutor and you're trying to get people, you have reason to believe that somebody poses a public safety threat, you think that they need to be held in the jail for 2 days, but the local jail doesn't have space because they're holding dozens of people for ICE to come pick them up. For a local prosecutor, that from their perspective, that's really bad for public safety because they are now having to let somebody go free who they think is a public safety threat because somebody else happens to be an immigrant and maybe they're on the, you know, the most basic of charges, not really anything that would raise violence concerns. But unfortunately, the jail has been filled up by those individuals instead of the people who are deemed a public safety threat by local law enforcement.
What would you most want folks at home to know about the No Bailout for Sanctuary Cities Act?
I would want them to know that this bill, which should be called the Defund Our Communities Act, is a danger to their local bus line, to their Meals on Wheels program, to their ability of social workers and teachers and bus drivers to just continue to do their work serving our communities. This is way bigger. Wherever you stand on immigration issues and even on sanctuary policies, you probably agree that we need local government to function. And now is not the time to be cutting funding to our local governments, unrelated funding that goes to support American families all across this country through the provision of local services. We shouldn't be handing more power to the Trump administration to feed programs into the wood chipper. We need a lot of these programs, and we need people to be able to continue to do their jobs. And that's why we need people to oppose this bill and call their member of Congress.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, getting in action, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, they should come to the ACLU website, aclu.org. They can take action through our website. They can be patched in to call their member of Congress. And we really want people to do that because even though the state of Oregon is considered by many to be a sanctuary state, there are still